I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Jackson Olson, Executive Director of School Success for Opportunity 180, and Justin Brecht, Founder and Executive Director of the Nevada Rise Academy, a local public charter school. Opportunity 180's Every Kid, Every Opportunity campaign is underway to bring awareness about educational options and help ensure that every kid in Nevada has access to a great school. Jackson and Justin, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Jackson, what exactly is Opportunity 180?
Opportunity 180 is an education nonprofit based here in Southern Nevada that works with a variety of different entities in the education landscape. Our organizational mission is all around our North Star of having every single kid graduating from high school, college and career ready, and prepared to live the life that they dream. So we kind of anchor all of our work around that North Star. And then backwards from there, you know, we do a lot of things. We manage federal grants. We work with philanthropists, local philanthropists, and invest in schools and in leaders. We facilitate helping leaders start charter schools. We work closely with the state, with the governor. We have a policy kind of branch of our work where we're very busy every 2 years at the biennial session up in Carson City. So we do a lot of different things, but at the end of the day, all of our work really comes back to this idea that every single kid in Southern Nevada and in the state of Nevada deserves to have a high quality education and a high quality free public school in their neighborhood. And so we do a lot of work to ensure that that idea and that vision comes to reality.
Awesome. And when was Opportunity 180 founded?
I'll have to check on the exact year, but I want to say it was in the mid-2010s. But our kind of most recent leadership transition with our new CEO happened during and around kind of the pandemic, so 2019, 2020. And since that time, we have kind of re-anchored ourselves in and our strategies in this North Star. And our mission not only around that North Star, but also around by the year 2030, having 100,000 more high quality seats for families and kids in Las Vegas. So while the organization, I think, started somewhere around 2015, maybe, we've kind of been in this most recent iteration since right around the start of the pandemic. And we have really a 10-year plan to really achieve that bold and audacious goal of having 100,000 more seats for families and kids here in Nevada.
Nice. Okay. And what does the name Opportunity 180 mean?
Well, opportunity, we believe in the idea that every family and every child should have the opportunity to attend a high quality public education, whether that's in the district or in a charter space. We don't think that income should be a dictator of quality access to education. And so we are really all about opportunity. And 180, just the concept of being able to, you know, if we're on the right path, great. But we know that there are a lot of schools and a lot of challenges in our education landscape here in Nevada. And so the idea is flipping the narrative and turning that around and making Nevada and even Las Vegas a beacon and a place to learn from, not just locally, but nationally. So we believe in kind of flipping the narrative and flipping the script on what education can be here in Nevada.
Nice. Okay. And Justin, what's the Nevada Rise Academy?
Nevada Rise Academy is a public school, a kindergarten through fifth grade, located in central Las Vegas, focusing on rigorous academics, character education, and preparing kids for their next steps in middle school, high school, and beyond.
And what would you say makes Nevada Rise unique?
What makes Nevada Rise unique is, first and foremost, our four-day school week. That is one differentiator. We do have work for staff on Friday and opportunities for kids to come to campus, but it's a four-day traditionally academic school week. I think the other primary difference is we are independent, so we're not part of the Clark County School District, which gives us the opportunity to make decisions based on the needs of our direct community of parents, kids, and teachers.
Okay, so I guess this is a question for both of you, but what exactly are charter schools?
That's a great question. There are a lot of myths out there or misconceptions about charter schools, so I'm glad that you asked. And first and foremost, if you hear nothing else, I'd want everyone to know that charter schools are free, public, and open to all. By state statute, there are certain requirements, and that means that charter schools can't charge tuition. They can't have admissions standards that disqualify certain populations or certain groups of students. They are free public schools. The difference, and I think one of the determining kind of characteristics, Justin alluded a little bit to it, is this idea of, you know, being an incubation space for change and innovation. It's not part of a large district. It's not part of necessarily like bound to some of the same certain requirements of a district school. So it just allows for some innovative approaches. Justin just mentioned a four-day school week for students. That's a pretty innovative out-of-the-box idea that a number of our charter schools have taken up in the last few years. That's an example, just one of many examples of how a charter school can operate differently, but it is a public state-funded school and it doesn't have any tuition requirements or any other requirements for a family or a student to attend there. And ultimately what it, you know, the charter movement started back in the 1990s and has grown dramatically since then. But when it first started, and even now to this day, the whole concept is create more of a free market economy in education so that families have more options. So that if you're a family that happens to have a district zone school that is really underperforming, that you at least have another option rather than just being pigeonholed into one specific school. Charter schools have opened up that option playbook for so many families here in Las Vegas. And Justin's school is a great example of one of those schools that's doing great things.
Yeah, I would just emphasize what Jackson said. There was a misconception that charter schools were tuition-based or not for. I'm always reminded of when we were opening and I was canvassing neighborhoods and mentioned that Nevada Rise would be a charter school. I had a parent that said, a charter school in our neighborhood? And that's always stuck with me just because it seemed like this elusive idea in our community. And then just echoing to Jackson's point about the need for them, Nevada Rise is a three-star school and it's only one of four three-star schools east of the 15 between Russell and Washington. And that just speaks to the quality of education in our area and the need for an option for parents seeking something different.
What prompted you to start Nevada Rise in the first place?
The opportunity to offer something different. I was actually a teacher in the school district for over a decade and ran a fairly innovative program. But when it came time to expand that program, I just ran into some bureaucratic hurdles that did not allow that to move in a direction that we could scale. And so with opportunity coming to life, I took the opportunity to do what I was doing in the classroom and expand that to a K-5 model.
Okay, awesome. So Jackson, tell us about the Every Kid, Every Opportunity campaign.
Sure. The campaign is, again, aligned to and anchored in this concept that every kid and every family in the state should have an opportunity to have a great education and a great free public school, a state-funded school that is tuition-free, to choose. And so right now we're pushing this Every Kid, Every Opportunity campaign through a variety of different avenues. Again, I mentioned that we do policy work up in Carson City, in the legislative session coming up. We'll be pushing really hard for some legislation and coordinating with lawmakers to make sure that more opportunities are available, especially in our communities and zip codes that are struggling from a lack of opportunity or a lack of options. And so on the policy side of things, that's a big push. In a public awareness angle, we're doing a lot of work as well. Coming on this show would be an example, but also just making sure that we're trying to do our best to educate the public on what charter schools are, what options families have available to them, and then really helping to incubate really strong charter models. That's another big leg of our work where we're supporting and developing future charter leaders and then supporting them through the process of being able to actually open more schools in these kind of zip codes that are deserts when it comes to, you know, quality public education options. So there are zip codes in our community right here in the Valley that don't have a 3, 4, or 5-star school. And so if you're a parent in that zip code, And the only option right now to you that is nearby in your neighborhood is just a district school. It would be great if we were able to offer more opportunities to our families. So every kid deserves it, and every opportunity that we would hope for our own children, that's what the whole campaign is about.
A lot of people complain about the education available in Nevada, and you're talking about having great schools for every kid. What's the latest data related to our educational landscape here in Nevada?
It's a great question. I'll start with a more big picture, and then we can drill down into some specifics. But one data point that I would want to share is that charter schools are growing, not just their enrollment, but the actual number of charters in the state of Nevada. Of course, Clark County is the largest district, followed by Washoe. And then right after that is the charter school, quote unquote, district. It's not necessarily a district, but these are schools that have been authorized by the State Public Charter School Authority, which is our state agency that authorizes and oversees, you know, the vast majority of our charter schools. So one data point to know is that charter school numbers and enrollment have both been on the rise steadily over the last several years. And we fully anticipate that by the next legislative session, meaning the one following this February, the SPCSA, which oversees all charter schools, will probably be the second biggest LEA or district in the state of Nevada. So that is an enrollment number that is climbing, where there are other districts where enrollment is decreasing. I had the privilege of serving on the SPCSA board recently. My term ended, but while I was on the board, you know, we got yearly data that showed, okay, our numbers are growing, but how are the schools actually doing? And I don't have all of the numbers and figures at my fingertip, but I can tell you that there were trends that showed that over the big picture, charter schools were outperforming district schools in the state of Nevada. Now, I don't want to create another misconception to say that all charter schools were outperforming all district schools. That would be incorrect. But just as a general trend, on the average, charter schools were outperforming district schools in the state. So the data is compelling. The data is encouraging. That doesn't mean that every charter school is hitting a home run. And it certainly doesn't mean that all district schools are low and underperforming. And at Opportunity 180, we really have like a district charter agnosticism. We believe in good public schools. And that means good district schools and good charter schools. And we work really hard to foster collaboration and progress in both of those domains. Right now, the majority of our work does happen to be with the charter sector, but that doesn't mean we are exclusively pro-charter. We're pro-kids, we're pro-families, we're pro-opportunity for all kids and all families in the state of Nevada.
Nice. Okay. Justin, where could local families find out more about the Nevada Rise Academy and how the programming works and maybe even apply to attend?
Yeah, you can learn more about us at NevadaRise.org. We also have an enrollment campaign through social media. And we also open our doors to anybody who wants a tour. We can offer that in advance, just calling us at the number on our website. Yeah, and that way you have a chance to actually see and feel our campus and learn how to become a part of that.
Just to build on that, I want to brag a little bit about Nevada Rise Academy because Justin's being a little humble right now. I would just want to share, you know, if I was a family, you know, near Eastern Avenue to where Justin's school is, I would definitely want to know not just that Justin's school was a 3-star school, according to the most recent state ratings, but they had the highest growth, I believe, and Justin, correct me if I'm wrong, but the highest growth of any elementary school in the state of Nevada. Meaning the kids who are going to his school are just growing at a rapid rate. And it means that they're making up for a massive amount of learning loss that could have been a result of the pandemic or just their circumstances. And so what Justin and his team are doing is awesome and it's special. So I definitely would encourage folks to check them out. And that also answers your previous question that I was talking about, kind of the bigger aggregate data, but if you drill down to some of our charter schools in our sector here in Nevada, we have some really amazing schools. So we have 5-star schools. We have schools like Justin's who are just making real, real progress to change the narrative about education here in the Valley. So just really encourage people to check them out. We don't have enough time on the radio show for us to list out all the great things that are happening there, but it's definitely something worth looking into.
Awesome. And Jackson, where can listeners find out more about Opportunity 180 and what you do in the community?
Sure. I mean, the best place would be on our website at opportunity180.org. And just click around there, you'll see a lot of the different ways that you could either get involved if you're interested in, as a community member, getting more involved in this conversation. We have a place where community members can create a profile to potentially serve on a charter school board. We have tools like a quality schools map where you can look at different zip codes and look at different star ratings of different schools, both district and charter. We have a great new data tool, School Scout, that allows you to see just real quick and easy data for schools like your neighborhood school, charter schools. You can compare and contrast schools. So anyway, our website is the home to all of these great tools and resources. And whether you're an educator or just a community member who is interested in this kind of thing, I think there's something there for everyone.
Awesome. So once again, those websites, if you want to find out more about Opportunity 180 and what they do, opportunity180.org is the website to go to, opportunity180.org. You can find out everything that they are doing, how they are promoting great schools for every kid in Nevada and helping to make the education system better, opportunity180.org. And if you'd like to find out more about the Nevada Rise Academy, which is a public charter school for K-5, you can go to their website, which is nevadarise.org. You can call them from there and make an appointment to have a tour, see what the school is like, and ask all your questions. NevadaRise.org. And we've been speaking today with Jackson Olson. He's the Executive Director of School Success for Opportunity 180, and also Justin Brecht, who's the founder and executive director of the Nevada Rise Academy. And I appreciate both of you being here and sharing more about the potential for charter schools, how they can be a great gift to the community and give more opportunity to more kids to have that experience of attending a great school and being able to graduate high school, college, and career ready. So I really appreciate both of you being here, part of this conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Heather.
When a student lacks basic needs like food, clothing, and learning materials, attending school can be a challenge.
And that can make it impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue by ensuring that students have everything they need to re-engage in learning,
access to technology and school supplies,
and even emotional support.
By bringing communities of support to students, we're achieving equitable learning conditions.
And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
Learn more at communitiesinschools.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Susan Myers, Director of Litigation for Nevada Legal Services and Project Manager for the Nevada Legal Kiosk Project. Free user-friendly Nevada Legal Kiosks are available in libraries statewide, and the project has recently added more legal kiosks in 6 new sites. Susan, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, Heather, thank you for having me.
So what is the Nevada Legal Kiosk Project?
Well, it is a project that placed 28 legal kiosks in libraries around the state. And the kiosks are one-stop portals to free legal information. They're all free resources, self-help resources, information about different areas of the law, ways to get forms. The idea was born out of the pandemic when the digital divide was exposed. And, you know, a lot of information, of course, went online, including and legal hearings as well and meetings. In addition, they helped to bridge the access to justice gap, especially in underserved communities and rural areas around the state where people don't have access to attorneys or legal information easily. It takes the place of having to Google around to try to find information and not knowing whether it's accurate or not. And we decided to place them in libraries because that's the trusted place that people go in their community for information.
Okay, so if someone can't afford a lawyer or they don't have a lawyer and they're trying to navigate through some kind of legal issue, whether it's family law, criminal law, whatever, Do these kiosks take the place of doing an actual consultation with a lawyer?
Not necessarily. They're more geared to be legal information so that you can try to learn more about your issue. We have a lot of information. It's all from nonprofit resources, such as the legal aid providers around the state. If you can't figure out the answer to your issue from the kiosk and you need more assistance, there's information about how to reach the different legal aid organizations. There's also information about how to access the State Bar of Nevada Lawyer Referral Service.
Okay. What has the feedback been from the public so far?
Very positive. We actually hear a lot of it through the librarians, and they've said that it's been a big help. The usage varies by location, because what would happen is people would come in to see them wanting legal information, and they maybe weren't prepared to offer it. So now they feel like they have a resource. So they give us feedback. So I'll ask, you know, what's the most popular topic that's being searched? Things like that. I can see the usage numbers, and I'm sorry, I don't have them pulled up right now, of how many views there have been. Last time I checked, it was over 3,000 uses, you know, and so they'll kind of fill us in and what people are looking for. And so, you know, we get a lot of feedback through the libraries rather than directly from the public. The public can leave, when you use the kiosk, you can leave a comment. To be honest, we haven't gotten a whole lot. We've had some, and especially when the project was new, there were people who maybe had trouble navigating or whatever, but it's designed to be very user-friendly, or, you know, some suggestions about topics people might like to see added, things like that. But it's been overwhelmingly positive.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned that there's 28 kiosks and 6 of them are new additions. What does that recent expansion mean for the project overall?
What it means is we were able to add them to some locations that when we did the initial 22, we had gotten a request from one library district that they would like one. So we were able to accommodate that. We were able to put a couple more in Reno where there was some need in their downtown area. And one of the big ones that I'm excited about is we were able to add one to the Clark County Law Library in downtown Las Vegas, because that was an area that wasn't being served.
Yeah, that's great. And is the Nevada Legal Kiosk Project a project of Nevada Legal Services?
Yes, the way that came about was the 5 legal aid organizations in the state, which are Nevada Legal Services. We are the one statewide organization with offices in Las Vegas and the North. A Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada in Southern Nevada, Senior Law Program in Southern Nevada, VARN, Volunteer Attorneys for Rural Nevadans, which covers the North, and Northern Nevada Legal Aid. The 5 legal aid organizations and our State Access to Justice Commission had heard about, I guess Minnesota started the first program, and they heard about it, thought it would be a great idea, and NLS agreed to administer the grant. So I was brought on as the project manager to get the project, to design the kiosks, not the technical part. We had a web developer for that, but I designed the legal interface, if you will, and what materials are on it. And then I just pretty much cold called or emailed libraries about the project. And most that I contacted were interested. And we went from there and installed them. And that's kind of how that came about.
Nice. And do most libraries in Clark County have one of the kiosks?
The libraries that have them in Clark County are North Las Vegas, all 3 branches. And then in the Clark County, Las Vegas Library District, I'll start with the most remote. We have Mesquite and Laughlin. And then we have East Las Vegas Library, Whitney Library, Sahara West, West Charleston. I think that covers Clark County. And now the Clark County Law Library downtown.
Okay. So pretty much all of the library districts except Henderson.
Correct. Well, Boulder City doesn't either. I think they're their own district. when we approached the library districts, like, for example, Las Vegas, Clark County, you know, we said, where do you want to, you know, we have this much funding for this many kiosks. Where would you like them placed? So we let the library districts decide that because they knew what their need was. And for example, things that were easily accessible on bus lines, because, you know, that would make it more usable for people who might not have cars, things like that, you know, areas where there's a need. So we let them decide.
Nice. Okay. So where can people go for more information about the kiosk project or to find the locations of the Nevada Legal kiosks when they're ready to go use the service?
Well, there are two ways they can do it. There is a website, legalkiosks.com, that has information on a number of projects, including Nevada. And if you click on the Nevada link, there is a map with the locations. It's a list and also a map, you know, so you can click on that. If you do have access to a computer at home, oh, and let me say one more thing. One of the other issues was, you know, a lot of people have smartphones, but I don't know about you, Heather, but I can't do a lot of complicated research or trying to fill out a form on a smartphone.
Right.
So if you want to look at it, you might have a computer. There is a way to access it from your own computer. It's nv.legalkiosks.com.
Perfect.
That takes you to the interface of the kiosk. Now, it might not necessarily have every feature that you will have in the library. For example, one thing I want to add is in the libraries, we offer free printers with the kiosk. So if you need to print out a form and you don't have a printer, you can go there and access it that way. But if you go to nvlegalkiosks.com, you'll see the Welcome to the Legal Kiosk sign. And if you're using it from a location not in the library, you can scroll down and you can see, because to access it, you have to click which library you're using it from. And you can click My Own Device and access the information.
Okay, awesome. So once again, those websites are legalkiosks.com is the main website for all the legal kiosks available around the country. And you can click on Nevada to see the local ones, legalkiosks.com. And if you want to go straight to the interface, nv.legalkiosks.com will take you right there. And you can, again, see a list of the locations, nv.legalkiosks.com. Also, if you'd like to find out more about Nevada Legal Services, nevadalegalservices.org. And we've been speaking today with Susan Myers. She's the Director of Litigation for Nevada Legal Services and also the Project Manager for the Nevada Legal Kiosk Project. And Susan, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know about this project. It sounds like a really great resource for people. And I know that a lot of people probably didn't know about it. The fact that it's free and set up with being able to fill out forms and print them and do the research with a reputable source instead of relying on just Googling random info. I think it's fantastic. So thank you for putting the project together. And thank you so much for being here today telling us about it.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure both to work on the project and to be with you this afternoon.
There's a place where veteran stories, the fabric of our nation's past, serve the future. Now your experiences can be an invaluable resource, a treasured piece of an ever-growing collection. Share your memories with us at the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where the experiences of U.S. military veterans are preserved. You'll help inform the next generation of students, scholars, researchers, and veterans too. To submit your stories, photographs, and other military documents, visit loc.gov/vets today.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Maria Ross, speaker, empathy advocate, founder of Red Slice, and author of the new book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries. Maria, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write your book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries?
I had written a previous book about empathy called The Empathy Edge that came out in 2019, and it was really the book that made the business case for the ROI of empathy and the fact that empathy could be a strategic advantage. It wasn't just good for society, it was great for business. And that came out pre-pandemic. And so I was delivering workshops and keynotes and talks to companies and organizations all over the world. And what I was finding was that some leaders were already on board with this idea of people-centered leadership, but they were struggling with some challenges around it, with burnout, with keeping performance standards high. And so I really wrote this book as a way to give those leaders a framework to balance both the needs of the business with the needs of their people, while also taking care of their own mental health and not just snapping back to bossism, as I like to say, but still continuing to embrace empathetic leadership.
Yeah, okay. What are some of the common misconceptions about empathy?
Well, I think the problem with being an empathetic leader is there's a lot of false narratives out there around what it means. It doesn't mean crying on the floor with your employees. It's not just about being nice. You can be nice, but not see someone else's perspective and take a next right step to move forward together. It's not about caving into unreasonable demands. You can still make really tough business decisions, but do that with empathy and compassion for the individuals that are impacted. And finally, it doesn't mean that you have to agree with someone. You can have an empathetic conversation to understand someone's point of view and their context and where they're coming from, but you don't have to walk away converted to one idea or the other. I like to say that empathy is about connection, not conversion.
Okay. Now, I think a lot of people associate empathy with emotions, and emotions don't belong in the workplace, blah, 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 blah. So what are the biggest challenges that are associated with having empathy in our world, in our workplace, as you've described, but getting past that mental block of, no, this is about emotions, we got to keep it out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that so hilarious because we're dealing with human beings and you can't just park your humanity at the office door when you go to work. So whatever is happening for you in your life, in the world, economically, culturally, is that actually going to, yes, impact your ability to do an accurate spreadsheet, for example. So we do have to bring emotions into the workplace because we're dealing with human beings. Now, we don't have to spend all our time there because we have work that needs to be done and results that have to be achieved. But I think that it's really important to understand that we're not talking about crying on the floor. We're just talking about being able to take a beat and understand someone else's perspective and leave the door open to maybe there's a different way to look at solving a problem or pursuing a certain strategy. That in and of itself is empathetic. And there's a lot of little things that managers and leaders can do in the organization that are empathetic other than having a really difficult conversation all up in our feelings. So, you know, things like empathetic benefits, for example, flexibility, wellness days, paid time off, extended mental health benefits, those are all perceived as empathetic benefits by employees. So we don't always have to be having like a difficult emotional conversation. And also understanding that empathy comes in two forms. There's cognitive empathy, where we use our head to imagine what something might be like for someone. But there's also emotional empathy or affective empathy, which is when we actually feel what they're feeling. But we use those tools to gather information about someone's context. So now we can act with compassion. Compassion is actually empathy in action. And like I said, that action doesn't have to mean changing your mind or caving in or agreeing. It could be just simply listening. It could be holding space. It could be making sure that you're prepared with the right answers to the questions somebody might have. So empathy doesn't always take the form of, you know, having a heart to heart with someone.
Yeah, that's a really powerful perspective shift there. Now, what are the 5 empathy pillars?
So these pillars are traits that I discovered across hundreds of empathetic yet effective and high-performing leaders that I interviewed, research that I compiled. These 5 pillars seem to be present within all of these leaders that seemingly effortlessly would be empathetic but also very high-performing. And those are self-awareness, self-care, clarity, decisiveness, and joy. And so when you have those elements really shored up as a foundational basis for yourself, you're able to show empathy without, you know, losing accountability, without letting performance slip, without creating an environment of indecision, which is super unempathetic, right? When you delay decisions because you, quote, don't want to hurt someone's feelings, that's actually not empathetic. You need to be able to have a compassionate, honest conversation with someone who's underperforming, but not in a punitive way. in a way that says, like, help me understand what's going on for you so we can support you to do your best work. That's a very different tenor of a conversation than, you know, do this or you're getting fired.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are some strategies for strengthening those five empathy pillars?
Oh, there's so many, but we'll touch on a few high level. So with self-awareness, the obvious thing is to get curious and put your ego aside and invest in some time of self-reflection and self-assessment. You can take the Enneagram, you can take Myers-Briggs, you can take Clifton StrengthsFinder, but get curious about your own strengths, your own weaknesses, and especially important, your own emotional triggers, because you have to have your own house in order in order to be empathetic with someone else. If you are not grounded, if you are not aware of your emotional triggers, you have no space in your brain to take on someone else's perspective without defensiveness or fear. So self-awareness is the key. And then with self-care, you know, we're not talking manis and pedis here. We're talking about what recharges you and your brain so that you can show up at your cognitive best and, yes, at your emotional best and be able to deal with situations without anger, without frustration, without flying off the handle. And so you need to be self-aware to know what you need for self-care. Self-care is also knowing your boundaries. So are you clear with your boundaries? Do you know what recharges you? Is it something active or passive? And are you making time each day to engage in that activity and show a model to your team of how to take care of themselves so they don't burn out either? And then finally, just as a top level tip for clarity, you know, clarity is not just kind, as Brené Brown says, it also enables you to hold someone accountable because you can't hold someone accountable to an expectation you've never set. So the best empathetic leaders understand this and they help people understand what are the unwritten rules around here? What are the assumptions I'm making that we all understand what professionalism means or good communication or, you know, work ethic? Those are things that different people have different definitions of when they come into the workplace. And so are you articulating that and having a discussion with your team, not just about someone's job description, but about this is how we do business as a team. This is how we're going to operate. It's sort of our code of conduct, if you will.
Yeah. Wow. Some fantastic tips there. So where can people find out more or get a copy of your book, The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries?
Well, thank you so much. I hope they will check out theempathydilemma.com or any of their favorite booksellers. It's available everywhere. And you know, when they go to theempathydilemma.com, they'll be on my website. They can check out my podcast. They can check out my speaking engagements and just also access some free resources.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website is theempathydilemma.com, theempathydilemma.com. The book is The Empathy Dilemma, How Successful Leaders Balance Performance, People, and Personal Boundaries. You can also find Maria's podcast. You can find plenty of free resources there, theempathydilemma.com. And of course, we've been speaking today with Maria Ross, speaker, empathy advocate, founder of Red Slice, and author. And Maria, great advice that you've given today and some amazing topics that you've opened up that need to be thought through. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me and amplifying this message.
We are the 25%. That's a quarter of all Americans, over 61 million people with a disability. Our differences make us 100% unique, just like you. 100% creative, passionate, determined, and proud. We are the 25%, and we want a world where everyone is 100% included. Easter Seals Disability Services. Change the way you see disability. We are the 25.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Dr. Christopher Liu, gastrointestinal oncologist and medical advisor for the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, as well as Alyssa Kay, colorectal cancer patient diagnosed at age 37 while she was pregnant. Advances in biomarker testing are transforming colorectal cancer treatment, offering patients therapies tailored to their unique cancer profile. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
So, Dr. Liu, what exactly is the Colorectal Cancer Alliance?
So the Colorectal Cancer Alliance is the leading organization that's dedicated to the advocacy and treatment for patients with colorectal cancer. They also specialize a lot in what we're talking about today, and that is biomarkers for colorectal cancer.
What are the symptoms of colorectal cancer?
You know, as it is with many cancers, the symptoms for colorectal cancer when people present with colorectal cancer are fairly vague. Some of the more common symptoms that patients describe would be abdominal pain, having a lower red blood cell count. One of the key findings for any patient that may be diagnosed with colorectal cancer is just seeing blood in the stool. That is an unusual finding. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have colorectal cancer. It just means that it's a symptom that should not be ignored and should definitely be discussed with your provider.
Okay. Now, you mentioned biomarkers. What exactly are they?
So biomarkers are really any test that's designed to find something unique or specific about a person's cancer. So this could be a gene or a protein. And what this is it gives providers the ability to be able to personalize therapy unique to that patient's treatment. And so what this means is instead of a one-size-fits-all treatment like chemotherapy that obviously has a lot of side effects, it's possible for physicians to be able to select a targeted therapy or an immune-based therapy that may be not only more effective against a patient's tumor, but may also have less side effects as well.
Okay, so how would these other types of therapies that could be identified through biomarker testing work? What types of treatment are they exactly?
So it's a great question. So if you find a mutation in a specific gene within a tumor, it is possible to be able to offer a patient a drug that can actually hit that specific mutation within the tumor. And so, you know, actually one of the most recent FDA approvals for colorectal cancer targets a gene called KRAS, one of the most commonly mutated genes in colorectal cancer. This is a very, very exciting situation because if you find a gene and you can target it, not only is that more specific to the cancer and more effective, it also potentially has less side effects.
Interesting. Okay. Alyssa, what has your experience with colorectal cancer been like?
So it all kind of started when I was 27 weeks pregnant with my son. And that's when I found out that I had stage 4 colon cancer. And along with one of the biomarkers that worked, the first time it did not work for the biomarkers, but for the second time it worked. And so along with the chemo and everything that was going through, it's kind of been kind of like a roller coaster up and down.
Yeah. And, you know, Heather, it's kind of interesting when you think about even Alyssa's story, when you start out initially with kind of like a one size fits all type treatment like chemotherapy, Alyssa's story really kind of brings that home. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. With the biomarker testing that Alyssa received, it allowed her providers to actually select the right targeted therapy to treat her cancer. It's really, you know, one of the success stories of when we find more information out about the tumor, you can actually select the more effective therapy. And I think that that's why Alyssa is in the situation that she is right now, where she actually has no evidence of disease, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. So it's basically like trying to figure out a puzzle and you've got the data and what does that mean kind of thing?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's just really, number one, looking. And that's one of the main take-home messages that we want everybody to come away with. If you have a diagnosis of colorectal cancer, just ask your doctor, has my tumor been tested for biomarkers? If it has, how will it impact my treatment? In other words, will it make a change in my treatment where I may be able to get a more effective therapy? And the other thing is that it's okay to wait to get that biomarker testing back to make sure that you get started on the right treatment. That's one of the things that we want everybody to know.
Okay. And what's involved in doing the biomarker testing?
Yeah. And so a lot of times, honestly, on the patient side, it's mainly just asking. And, you know, this is something that Alyssa and her family went through where, you know, she asked for, you know, biomarker testing to make sure that it got done. On the provider or physician side, it sometimes means doing a blood test. Sometimes it actually means doing a test on the tumor. But that's something that all, you know, hospitals and, you know, they can even send these tumors out to other companies to get this testing done. But it can be done and it should be done.
Okay. And what about insurance coverage? Is that a factor in getting biomarker testing done?
I think one of the things that we all worry about is, and I'm sure Alyssa can attest to this too, am I going to receive a gigantic bill when it comes to, getting biomarker testing? We want to reassure people there are FDA-approved tests for biomarkers that are largely covered by insurance. This is becoming less and less of a problem because we're in a new age of cancer therapy where biomarkers are expected to be tested for, and we expect it to modify a patient's treatment plan. There are also patient support programs for this testing as well, just in case. But for more information, we want everybody to have, the ability to go to this website, colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers. That's colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers to get more information about this testing and how it may impact their treatment.
Awesome. And Alyssa, any final words that you would like others to know if they're going through the colorectal cancer journey as well?
Yes, if you think that you have like the symptoms, I'd rather have them go get checked out and go talk to their doctor and get a colonoscopy done.
Nice. Okay. So once again, that website is colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers. That's the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers. And you can find out all about the new biomarker testing and how it can help patients who are going through colorectal cancer. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Christopher Liu. He's a gastrointestinal oncologist and a medical advisor for the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, as well as Alyssa Kay, who's a colorectal cancer patient. And I really appreciate you both being here and raising awareness about these new treatment options that people could take advantage of if they find themselves on that journey. So thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about, but you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/getscreened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and joining me is Sue Peschen, President and CEO of the Alliance for Aging Research. An estimated 54,000 people in Nevada are currently living with Alzheimer's, and 84,000 in the state are caring for people with Alzheimer's or other dementias. A new poll commissioned in part by the Alliance for Aging Research shows an overwhelming bipartisan demand for improving access to innovative FDA-approved early treatments. Sue, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So, what are the barriers that prevent Alzheimer's patients from accessing drugs to slow the disease's progression?
Yes. So in 2022, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs the Medicare program, set up a unique utilization management barrier for these FDA-approved drugs that treat early Alzheimer's disease. And they had never done this before for on-label use of a prescription drug. And what they did was they used a tool that they created themselves called coverage with evidence development. And even though the FDA said these drugs are safe and effective for use in the clinical setting, CMS, which is essentially a payer, Medicare is a public insurance program, is sort of second-guessing FDA and saying, we're going to require collection of evidence, so we're going to make folks jump through a few extra hoops in order to get access to these therapies. So folks can still go to their doctors and ask whether or not they're eligible, but it's just a little bit more limited in terms of the types of doctors and the places where you can get the medications.
What are some of these new treatments that have an extra barrier in place now?
So there are two, and one of them is called Kisunla, and the other one is Leqembi. And they're both treatments for early Alzheimer's disease that were approved in the last couple of years by the FDA. These are not curative therapies, but they are disease modifying. They're the very first disease modifying therapies to be approved for Alzheimer's disease, which that means basically they can delay decline. And that's really important to a lot of families because it allows folks to be independent for a bit longer and to be more themselves for a little bit longer. And every day is important. It's estimated that about 2,000 folks progress out of the early phase a day. So people who aren't able to get access, you know, get out of that window where the drugs would otherwise be beneficial.
And what are some of the hoops that they would have to jump through in order to get access to the medicines?
Well, they have to be willing to participate in a clinical study, which these drugs have already gone through clinical study. And like I said, you know, were approved by the FDA, but Medicare added this additional barrier. So they have to agree and their doctor has to agree to input information every several months into these registries. And then those registries are used in clinical studies to analyze the data over time. And they have to agree to participate. So if they're not comfortable with that, or if, you know, they're not able to get to a clinician that's participating in one of these registries, then they have to either pay out of pocket or they're out of luck.
Wow. Okay. Now, what are some of the key highlights revealed in your recent poll about this issue?
Yeah, I mean, overwhelmingly and really across the political spectrum, which makes this really like a core issue, everybody agrees that Medicare should immediately cover the cost of these FDA-approved drugs. We had 89% of voters who said that, and about 78% said the government should not require patients to participate in medical research studies on any FDA-approved drug in order to get access. And that if Medicare doesn't change this, 78% agree Congress should step in to require Medicare to do it.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that this was the first time these types of barriers have been put in place. So what kind of precedent does keeping them in place set for others living with chronic conditions, maybe other chronic conditions?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're really concerned about, is it really has opened up this doorway. And spokespeople for the Medicare program and researchers who support the work that they're doing around this have even said that we're likely to see more of these on new types of gene therapies and stem cell therapies in the years to come for other types of conditions like cancers, rare diseases. So this will not be a one-off.
Some of this is obvious, but what are some of the ways that limited access to treatment could cause harm, not only to patients, but their families and our economy as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, you want, hopefully, you know, your loved ones to be able to stay home as long as possible. And the faster the disease progresses without any type of intervention, the more likely folks are to need institutionalization, to need extra help as they progress along. It's very costly for families to take care of their loved ones at home. My mom has Alzheimer's, and it's a strain on both of us financially, emotionally. And, you know, it's not easy to always find help and extra care, you know, to supplement. So there's a lot of issues around this disease. And I'm very blessed that she's with me. I think a lot of families feel the same way. But, you know, we need support. And to have the public program of Medicare, which we all pay into as taxpayers, sort of cherry pick this disease and say, too bad, there's too many of you, we want to try to save costs. That's not fair. And that's not what you expect when you get older and you get sick.
Yeah, absolutely. Where can listeners go to learn more about this issue or make their voices and opinions heard?
Absolutely. Visit us at agingresearch.org. We have a lot of information on Alzheimer's and a number of other chronic conditions as well as more background on this issue. And if you're looking for support in your local area, visit the Alzheimer's Association at alz.org, and they can connect you with your local chapter.
Nice. Okay. So once again, those websites are agingresearch.org. You can find out more information on chronic conditions. You can find out about these barriers that are in place for early Alzheimer's patients, agingresearch.org. And if you're looking for resources for a loved one who has Alzheimer's, alz.org. That's the Alzheimer's Association, alz.org. And we've been speaking today with Sue Peschen. She's the president and CEO of the Alliance for Aging Research. And Sue, it's really great that you're here bringing, first of all, more information to people who weren't aware about the issue, and also coming with verified opinions from other people who have spoke up about the issue. It's a bipartisan issue. It's not something that is specifically one political party or another. It's people across various demographics who agree that patients should have access to these treatments. So thank you so much for being here today and sharing information about it with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
I taught for 20 years until I started forgetting my lectures.
Eventually, he had to quit. Getting his early Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard, but it gave us time to take control of the situation together.
I can't imagine going through this without him.
If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together. For more information, visit alz.org/timetotalk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. The City of Henderson is calling on talented artists to create unique murals at 5 public locations throughout the community, including parks and the Water Street District. You can attend an online informational session this Tuesday, January 7th at 6 p.m., and applications are open through Monday, January 13th. Apply or get more information at cityofhenderson.com. That's cityofhenderson.com. And the Shade Tree is holding its Hope for the New Year fundraising campaign through the end of January. Donations will support the shelter's comprehensive programming and operations while expanding its outreach. Any amount helps, and you can donate at theshadetree.org. That's theshadetree.org.